If you walk across your yard and it feels more like a sponge than solid ground, you're not alone this summer. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It has been a hot, wet summer in Iowa. Many areas have received twice as much rainfall as usual, and the ground is saturated. Today, we'll talk about the impact all that water has had on your yard and your garden. The wet, hot conditions have been great for some plants and not so great for others. We'll talk about vegetable gardens, fruit crops, trees, and shrubs. Linda Nave, Iowa State University Extension Specialist, will be here along with Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron. We'll talk about the water and we'll answer your questions. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join the conversation after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It is Horticulture Day today, and you don't need me to tell you that it's been a wet summer in Iowa. Many areas of the state, including Des Moines, Ames, Newton, Dubuque, and Ottumwa, and of course all the surrounding areas, have racked up between 20 and 24 inches of rain so far this season. And of course, we've got showers in the forecast today. Iowa State University Extension Specialist Linda Nave and Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron are here with us today, and we're going to start by talking about all of that water and what it's done to your yards and gardens. Hello, Linda and Richard.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. Linda, let's start in the garden. With all of that water and the wet soil and the hot conditions, how have vegetable gardens fared this summer?
Well, vegetable gardens have fared fairly well early in the season because we got timely rains and things were growing really well. Then the heat came and all the other rains. And so what we are seeing now, just as our tomatoes and other crops are really setting on, particularly tomatoes, all of a sudden they're getting wiped out, especially those that were grown directly on the ground and not supported by cages, stakes, or any type of a trellis. So these crops are really taking a hit.
And why are they taking a hit?
Well, we have foliage diseases showing up on our tomatoes, early blight, septoria leaf spot, and then if our fruit is sitting directly on the saturated soil, they're going to rot quickly even before they start to turn red. And we have another disease called anthracnose that attacks the fruit. And typically anthracnose looks like little sunken, almost bruised areas that may be the size of, an M&M to begin with or smaller. And then they'll grow and consume a large portion of the fruit. And it doesn't take long. You may harvest it. It looks great. But that little blemish will continue to grow. And it won't be long and that fruit is rotting. And it may, if you don't catch it in the field, you'll see it at home. What can you do about it? Well, at this point, it's a little bit late. I think we just got to chalk up our losses because you could use a fungicide, but usually that's a preventative type spray rather than a control. So you can pick good fruit a little early and take your chance to see if it gets anthracnose or not. Once it starts to color up, you could harvest it and bring it indoors. Also, this heat will prevent just that deep red ripening in tomatoes. Temperatures regularly over 90 will reduce that redness and it'll be more of an orange fruit. So sometimes people will pick them a little bit early and ripen them indoors where it's cooler. You'll get a better coloration on the tomatoes.
But that won't affect the taste of them, would it?
A little bit, it does. You lose that vine ripened flavor, but not a lot, but you can definitely tell the difference.
You know, when we think about, of course, you want rain for your garden and you want sun and warmth for your garden, but we've just had too much of both this year.
Yeah, we kind of got excess of everything just in the last six weeks or so. But early in the season, it was looking pretty good because our timely rains came, reducing our need to irrigate, and nothing is really better than rainwater on some of our crops.
So what about the other vegetables in the garden? How have they been affected?
Well, let's take potatoes, for example. Potatoes are a root crop. Carrots are a root crop. And this is the time of year, maybe in the last 4 weeks, we should have been digging our potatoes because the vines have died down. And some people leave them in and harvest them later in the season. That way they don't have to store them. But what the problem we run into now is if the soil holds a lot of water and is quite saturated, those potatoes will be rotting, getting a bacterial soft rot in the soil, and you lose them.
So you need to get them out now, or is it too late?
I would say get them out now if it's not too late. I would go out there. You'll definitely know if your potatoes are rotting in the garden because the odor definitely tells you that when you start digging. If you had a little insect injury on those potatoes or those carrots, that opens the wounds for the disease problems to set in.
What about cucumbers and zucchini, some of the crops that we talk about having a hard time getting rid of because they're so productive? Have they been affected by this as well?
A little bit with the foliage diseases, and zucchini, I think, can keep going and going and going if you keep them productive. If they're sitting on, the fruit is directly sitting on the soil, yes, you'll have some fruit rotting. But if it's elevated a little bit, those plants are probably doing okay. Cucumbers right now, the rainy weather may have affected our pollination on these crops. That keeps the bees and the other pollinators out of the field, and thus we get curled, incomplete pollination on the fruit, causing one end of the cucumber to be very skinny or maybe hourglass-shaped. The same with zucchini. And zucchini, you might run into some blossom end rot on the ends of the fruit. So there are some issues, but that's about it. But I think pollination may be the key factor in our cucumbers.
Are we going to see a lot of problems with squash and pumpkins, the kinds of things that lay on the ground, or watermelons?
Yes, definitely. Watermelons and muskmelons here in the heavy soils in gardens really had raised havoc because the plants were absorbing so much water, and tomatoes too, that as they ripen, they crack and burst open. Almost the muskmelon almost blow out. You can just see the end of the fruit just blowing out before they're really ready to pick or at harvest time. Watermelons, a little bit of the same way, but not as much. And anything that's just sitting on the ground in a saturated situation is going to rot because your decomposing organisms, your decomposers, will start working away on that fruit because it's sitting there, no air, in the water, just prime conditions for some rot to set in.
Well, how about fruit trees? How have fruit crops been affected by all of this rain this year?
Well, as far as trees and fruit trees, with fruit trees, the main thing there is they insist on a well-drained soil. And with all the rain, if you have a soil that has a lot of clay in it, if it doesn't drain well, there may be too much moisture in the soil, and that can lead to a root rot. And so the trees could very, very suddenly basically die. It's unfortunate, but that's a real concern because they really insist on that well-drained soil. So if you have something like a cherry or some other fruit tree, and all of a sudden all those leaves basically dry up and fall off, and you have this bare tree, that would suggest that it has a root rot or some other problem. And in fact, it may be dead or dying. So that could be a very serious problem.
In 1993, with all of the flooding, a lot of people lost their cherry trees. Are we going to see a lot of dead cherry trees this year?
We could, because cherries, plums, apricots, they really insist on that well-drained soil. And when you have a wet year like this year, even those areas that are fairly well drained, just because it's raining so often, may be a little bit too wet. So when you do plant a fruit tree, really check around and make sure you choose a well-drained soil. It really does pay off in the future because these things do happen periodically where we have a wet year. And when that occurs, then you can see some major problems.
Yeah, we had a beautiful cherry crop in my yard this year, and now it looks like we've lost one of our cherry trees.
It could be, yes. Unfortunately.
How about apple trees? You didn't mention apple trees in that list.
Apple trees are on that list, too. They're not as finicky, I don't think, as the cherries and the plums. Those plants in the prunus are stone fruits. But they still like a well-drained soil, too. So they could be a problem. I think the bigger problem on things like apples and crab apples is kind of a short-term problem. Things like apple scab, cedar apple rust, those are fungal leaf diseases, very common because we had a wet spring, and they will cause spotting of the foliage, they'll cause premature leaf drop, and so on some of the crab apples and some of the apples, you may have trees that have lost maybe half or maybe two-thirds of their foliage, but they're not totally bare. They're okay. They're going to survive it, but they've been injured slightly, but they should recover. So as long as they have leaves, that's most likely a leaf-type disease, and they'll survive it. You really can't do much to help. But if they drop all their leaves, then most likely they have died.
So just offer moral support and cross your fingers. I know that some people have mentioned to me noticing early maturation of apples this year with all the heat. Is that a trend that we've seen this year?
I guess I haven't seen that, no.
Not seen it or heard it.
Okay.
No. Weather conditions obviously can affect maturity, depending on how quickly we have our bloom in the spring. The weather conditions in late spring and summer, they can definitely affect maturity, but I haven't heard that it's going to be an early crop this year. I haven't heard that.
With some of the leaf spotting and the problems that fruit trees have had, is that going to cause any problems with them getting through the winter?
It could have. It might weaken them a little bit. But fortunately, most of the things like crab apples and apples, they're quite hardy to begin with. So I think they'll be okay. Apple scab, cedar apple rust, they're fairly common on certain varieties. It occurs most years to some extent. The best that the individual can do typically is when they're buying, for example, a crab apple especially or an apple, check into their disease resistance. You can buy apples and crab apples that are resistant to apple scab and cedar apple rust, and that's probably the best way to avoid the problem. You can spray if you are willing to spray like two or three times in the spring, but most people just don't have the time. And when you consider the fact that apple scab and cedar apple rust, it's really not going to kill the trees, most people decide to do nothing because it's just not worth the effort. But you can buy apple scab, cedar apple rust resistant apples and crab apples, and I would choose those varieties.
Fruit trees, you mentioned, like to be well-drained. Do they tend to be a little more temperamental in that way than other kinds of trees?
Well, there are, as far as ornamental trees, you have your maples and willows and things like that. Certain trees actually like wet soils, things like willows. Bald cypress, they really actually like moist to wet soils. Other trees would prefer a well-drained, so it kind of depends upon the tree species. But there are a number of trees that actually thrive in kind of wet to moist soils. So they're doing fine. Willows, bald cypress are doing just fine. While some of the other trees, maybe like some of the bur oaks, would prefer a drier situation.
Yeah, we planted a couple weeping willows this year, and I'm very happy we made that decision. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. We're talking with Linda Knave and Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension, and we'll be taking your calls when we come back from the break. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can send us email as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It is Horticulture Day today. And with us today are Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and Iowa State University Extension specialist Linda Knave. And if you have a question about your yard or garden, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Before we start taking calls, I want to ask a little bit about some of the other ornamentals that we might have in our yards, like perennials and shrubs. How have they fared with all of this wet weather?
I think they've done reasonably well. There are some perennials that may have declined just because it's been too wet. Again, many of those like well-drained soils too. And if it stayed wet for a long period, some of those perennials could decline and possibly eventually die. So again, if you see something that's not doing well, that may be the main reason.
All right, there's not much to do about it, though.
No, you can't.
I think a lot of the problems come with some of the plants that are lower growing, in which the foliage does sit on that wet soil. Lady's mantle, heuchera, small flowered alum root. Not the name, common name of it, Richard. Anyway, these plants tend to show symptoms a little sooner because the crown, the foliage originates from a crown of the plant, and I've noticed some damage with that.
All right. Clarence is on the line today. He's on the road driving through Iowa. Hello, Clarence.
Yeah.
Hi, what's your question?
I bought a Masaba cherry tree last week, and I planted it in my yard. I live 200 miles north of Minneapolis. The tree calls for a zone 4, and actually a zone 3 up there. Is there anything I can do in the fall to prepare it to make it through the winter that would give it a better chance to live?
There's really not much you can do as far as dealing with a cold hardiness issue when you have a tree. You really can't wrap it. You really can't do much of anything. It's just the cold temperatures and the effect on the twigs and branches and buds. And if you get extreme cold, that can damage them. And there's not much you can do to really protect them, unfortunately. Now, if that tree were near a building like the house, it might stay a little bit warmer than in an open exposed site in the middle of the yard. But that's about all you could probably do.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Clarence. Thanks a lot for your call. We've got Dick on the line from Dubuque. Hello, Dick.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was hiking yesterday on the prairie by Dubuque, and I see the prairie grasses and flowers look like they're about twice as big as normal. So I don't know. Maybe they're almost like the tropics. Maybe they're this climate has been more friendly towards them. And, of course, anything really like the goldfinches or have a feast, and bees, too, I guess. So apparently they were less affected by some of the water problems, and it actually helped them.
Well, with something like a big bluestem, which is a native prairie grass, that can be very, very tall. Now, obviously, if you have a dry year, it's going to be shorter, and if you have a wet year, much taller. So they will vary in size, but some of those are doing very, very well because a moist prairie is actually what they like.
Mm-hmm. I have noticed that, too, that other things such as Shasta daisies have really grown taller than the typical size, and other things, and especially some of their native prairie plants, purple coneflower, even the rudbeckia. So that is an interesting observation.
It's nice to know that some things can grow in a sauna and, mm-hmm. and really love it. Dick, thank you so much for your call. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also send us email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. David is on the line in Forest City with a potato question. Hello, David.
Hi. Yeah, I was listening to the program this morning. I ran out in the garden quickly because I understood that maybe we should be digging our potatoes early. I dug a couple up, and a couple look really okay, but a bunch of them are still green. And I'm wondering, do I leave them, and can a person eat green potatoes, or where do I go from here?
Well, you've got an interesting question there. Green potatoes, well, let's just back up and talk about the potato plant first. Potatoes are produced on underground stems called stolons, and they're the tip of those underground stems. And like all stems, they contain chlorophyll, but if they're underground, that chlorophyll isn't developed. But if that chlorophyll, if that potato tuber is exposed to light, that chlorophyll starts to develop and the potato tuber turns green. The problem with the rains and how did the rain affect those green potatoes is the fact that it washed the soil away from the potato tuber, exposing them to light, causing them to turn green. And it's probably common this year, too, and I hadn't even thought about that. The green potatoes, if you can peel them deeply and get rid of the green, or if the potato is nearly all green, I would discard them because that green is somewhat toxic and if eaten in large amounts could cause some stomach ailments and other things. So we don't recommend using green potatoes. So that's the problem right there.
Okay. With leaving them, number one, I have them under a good amount of peat moss. And so, as far as I know, there wasn't any direct sunlight, but obviously some has gotten to mm-hmm. them. Would leaving them any longer make any difference?
Definitely not. I would take them out of the garden, and I'm not real sure how much they would turn back and the green would go away. Probably they would rot before that. So they're just not a good quality, not a good flavor.
Okay.
I would just discard them.
Okay, thank you.
All right, David, thanks a lot for your call. We have another potato question from Cecile in Iowa City. Hello, Cecile.
Hi. I heard you say dig the potatoes now, but then you have to keep them cool and around 40 degrees, I guess. But I read somewhere that you shouldn't put them in the refrigerator, and I don't see any other way of keeping them cool enough, particularly in the weather we're having. So what do you recommend to keep them cool?
Well, initially, they're not going to sprout for several weeks. So they'll be okay for several weeks. I would just try to find the coolest place you can find, maybe the garage, maybe the porch. Make sure it's a dark area, and leave them there. And then later, as temperatures get cooler, maybe find a different place for them. But initially, they won't sprout for several weeks. Then after that several-week period, if the temperatures are too warm, then they will sprout. So later on, try to find a place. Maybe the garage might be okay later on, but just a cool place, a dark place.
But not a refrigerator.
But not a refrigerator, no.
Why can't you cook potatoes in the refrigerator?
Well, if you refrigerate them, oftentimes that starch turns to sugar, and you lose your quality of your potato.
Okay.
Also, potatoes first dug do better if they're exposed to warmer temperatures, so that skin adheres better to the tuber, gets a little bit thicker, and is more appropriate for storage later. So actually, and helps dry off that excess soil on the tuber. So it's a good thing at first. So
under optimum conditions, how long can you keep potatoes?
If you have a storage site where the temperature is around 40 degrees, you can keep those typically for like 2 or 3 months easily if you have that temperature. But for most homeowners, that's the difficult thing.
Yeah.
Where are you going to put them where the temperature actually is around 40? In the old days, they used to have root cellars and caves and places like that. And that worked wonderful, but nowadays we don't have those things, so it's more difficult.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Cecile. And it's probably not a great time to go out and dig a root cellar.
It'd be rather hard.
Right. It'd be more like digging a pond.
Right, exactly. We've got one more potato question we can fit in before the break. Dave is on the line from Spencer. Hello, Dave.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
The past 2 years, my white potatoes have been extremely knobby, and they have lots of growths on them, and the yield is really good, and they're really large potatoes, but they just have knobs all over them. Do you know what the problem is there?
Well, my guess of that would be regrowth, a little regrowth on the potato tuber as it's developing, and it could be a variety response. Have you changed varieties at all?
No, I haven't, but I have a friend that grows the same variety, and they're beautiful, and I'm just curious. I was wondering if there's possibly insects could be damaging them, and then they grow in response to that, because it seems like there's a lot of ants in the soil.
No, that wouldn't do it. My guess would be either you have a very rocky soil that the tuber has to grow around, or you've had inconsistent moisture or conditions like that, which the potato kind of slows down in growth, and then all of a sudden we get a lot of good moisture for that garden, and it resprouts another little tuber on top, not a tuber on top, but another little growth emerging from the original tuber.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot, Dave. They may not be pretty, but I hope they taste good. You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. We're talking with Iowa State University Extension Specialist Linda Nave and Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron, and we're taking your questions. The number is 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. From NP Public Radio, I'm Charity Nebbe, and it is Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa. With us are Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Iowa State University Extension Specialist Linda Nave, and we are taking your questions about your yard and your garden. The number to call is 866-780-9100. The lines are open right now, 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.com. www.thepotato.org. And we have an email today from Sherry, and she says, I have a lilac bush that I planted about 2 years ago. It has done well, but suddenly in the last month, the leaves started turning grayish-brown, starting on one section of the bush and spreading. The leaves aren't dry and curling up or dropping off. Another lilac in the area of the yard had the same problem last summer. I lopped off the affected branches, and it's thriving today. What is the problem?
Hard to say based on that. A couple possibilities would be possibly the lilac borer, which is an insect, and also known as the ash borer. It attacks both ash and lilac.
But it's not the emerald ash borer.
Right, it's different. And if this were the case, if you looked at the base of the larger stems, you would see holes in the actual stems and maybe some sawdust-like material at the opening of the holes caused by the insect. That's a possibility. Another possibility would be, again, the very, very wet weather that we've had the last 2 years. And you could have some type of root rot or crown rot occurring on those plants where maybe a portion of the root system is rotting, no longer functioning, and then some of those stems basically die out. So I would examine the plant and see what you see, but it could be maybe a root rot or crown rot or possibly the lilac borer.
She suggested that it might be, and I'm not going to say this correctly, but is it a verticillium wilt?
I'm not sure if verticillium wilt affects lilacs or not. It does affect a large number of trees and shrubs. So it's a possibility, but I don't know. Some plants are resistant to verticillium. Other plants are highly susceptible to it. I'm not sure where lilacs fall in that. So I'm not sure.
Okay, we have Don on the line in West Des Moines. Hello, Don.
Yes.
What's your question today?
Well, I have several flowering crab trees, and I've used fruit eliminator on them in the past, but it rained during the period when I needed to spray that on this year, and they are quite tall. Is there anything else that I can do to help eliminate the bearing of the fruit?
Nope, you basically get one shot in the spring when they're blooming, and you can spray them at that time with some type of fruit eliminator, and that hopefully would then cause the small little fruit to abort and fall off. But you only get one shot, and if you don't or can't do it during that time period, then you really can't do anything. It's going to bear fruit.
Yes.
So,
I'm bearing that pressure this year for sure.
Maybe it's time to make some crab apple jelly.
There you go. That sounds very good. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Don. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Dot is on the line from Stratford. Hello, Dot.
Yes, I have a question. There's lots of information out about what you can plant to attract butterflies, hummingbirds, and various things. But are there plants that you can plant around a deck or other outdoor areas that will keep mosquitoes away?
No.
Oh.
I'm sorry, but no, there really isn't.
Somebody had made a lot of money by this time if there was.
There used to be ads in some of the Sunday flyers about a plant that would repel mosquitoes, and like lemongrass or something of that nature. And indeed, if you took a plant like that and were to bruise it.
Roll in it?
Well, bruise it or smash it, it does produce a fragrance that tends to repel them to some extent. But the plant just sitting there is not going to do anything. You basically have to somehow take that leaf or take that plant and actually bruise or actually crush the plant tissue to produce that fragrance. And then that fragrance would kind of repel them to some extent. So you saw those things about 5 or 10 years ago. I think that most people have found out they don't really work, so you don't see them anymore. But you really can't repel mosquitoes with plants. So you have to get something like DEET or some other repellent.
Dot, do you live in a place where you can put up a bat house?
Yeah, we have bats here in town, plenty of them. And we also have a huge population this summer of dragonflies.
Yeah, dragonflies, purple martins, various things. That'll help a little bit, but when you're dealing with maybe millions of mosquitoes, it's just a kind of small part that they play.
Yeah. All right. Well, good luck, Dot. Thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
We also now have Scott on the line from Mason City. Hello, Scott.
Hi. I've got a question about pole beans this year. I helped some elderly garden in three or four different places, and so I put the upright beans in so they wouldn't have to bend over to pick. The plants look vigorous. They're the right color. They're covered with blossoms. No beans. I wonder if there's something causing them to abort.
The only thing that I could think of would be maybe be the temperatures. Very warm temperatures might interfere with pollination.
Bush beans look great. And they're just loaded, and they're in the same, like a row over.
Right. But plants vary somewhat in their heat tolerance, and maybe that's the case. If they're blooming but not forming then the pods, then that would suggest something is interfering with pollination. Mm-hmm. They don't require insects for pollination, so that's not the issue. So then the issue probably is the temperature. And we've had some very warm temperatures, 80s, low 90s, 70s at night, and those are a little bit warm for some things, and that can affect pollination. So my thought would be it's a temperature issue, and if they still keep on blooming and the weather moderates as far as temperature-wise, then they should go ahead and bear some fruit.
I see. One little quick side note. I'm involved with the Men's Garden Club up here in Mason City, and we had planted some indigenous balsam along the river right before the flood. And canoeing down the Winnebago River the other day, I see balsam for like 40 miles now on the riverbanks. It absolutely covered with pollinators, just absolutely covered with pollinators. So it turned out it worked well for us, even though we did have the flood. So,
all right. Well, that's an interesting side note. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Scott.
You bet.
All right. The next up, we've got Art from Edgewood. Hello, Art.
Hi.
What's your question today?
Okay. I've got some 10-year-old Korean lilacs as a foundation planting around my house. They've become overgrown, much too tall and hiding the entire wall. Should I cut those back or should I purchase some new ones and replant?
Well, I'd probably cut them back, and I'd probably do it in late March, early April, and realize they're not going to bloom next year, but that you can cut them back, and they'll come out of it quite nicely, but they won't bloom next year. They will the following year, but not next year. But if they really do need to be pruned severely or replaced, I would probably just cut them back severely next year.
Okay. Do you have to do some root pruning with that as well?
No, you don't have to, no. Okay. But they'll grow back very quickly. They may be back to their mature size in 2 or 3 years because they have a good root system, a well-established root system. So they'll grow back very quickly. It's not going to be a long-term thing, but you can prune them back. They tolerate that pretty well.
Okay. Thank you much.
Thanks a lot for your call, Art. The number to call if you have a question is 866-780-9100. You can send us email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're talking with Iowa State University Extension Specialist Linda Nave and ISU Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron today. And we have Dan on the line from Davenport. Hello, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. What's your question?
I've got a oak tree. It's about 15 years old. And I believe it's a bur oak, but on the leaves I've got they're little brown balls or spots or balls, and I don't know what it is.
Now, if it's actually kind of a abnormal bump or growth on the leaf, rather than a spot per se, if it's a growth, then that is some type of gall, and a gall is abnormal growth induced to form by a mite or a very small insect. And galls are very, very common on oak trees. especially on oak trees. A number of insects will, in the spring, they will inject some type of compound into that developing leaf, and then the tissue around that area then grows abnormally, kind of analogous to like a wart on your hand or something like that. And depending on the insect, they produce a different type of gall. Some galls might be as big as a ping pong ball. Some are kind of roundish. Some are kind of spindle-shaped. They vary in size, color, shape, depending on the actual insect or mite responsible for the gall. Now, the bottom line, as far as the tree is concerned, it's not a big deal to the tree. It's a minor nuisance to the tree. So the tree itself is fine, even though the leaves may be covered with these galls. So we don't have to do anything. We just kind of ignore the situation. But there are some that are very interesting. For example, there's one gall that forms on an oak leaf. It drops out of the leaf and then falls to the ground and then begins to jump on the ground, which is a rather odd little thing. But there's an insect inside there, and it actually moves. It's called the jumping bean gall, so it's very odd.
That's not very common, though, is it?
No, it's not very common, but it's a gall, and galls are very, very common on most trees.
That would be interesting.
Okay. Well, my wife will be happy to hear that.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Dan.
Thank you. Well, that,
even if it's not very common, it's sure fun to talk about.
It would be.
Right?
A cat would go crazy out there seeing those little leaves jump, wouldn't they?
Absolutely.
The little
absolutely.
Galls themselves drop out, and then they're jumping on the ground. Mm-hmm. So it's rather bizarre.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Maybe it'll get more widespread. Should we hope for that? Or probably not.
Probably
no.
not.
Okay. Well, Peg is on the road today. Hello, Peg.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about, we have a new construction. Our house is new in the last 3 years. And the land that it was in had been a field. So it was like a cornfield and bean field. And so there's probably some, there had been some residual herbicides over the years because it had been, you know, a field for years. And the other thing was there's a fair amount of, while the black dirt was very, very deep in the top when the soil was all moved around, it seems like there's a fair amount of clay in some spots. We've planted a number of new trees, some smaller, with maybe a 1-2 inch diameter, and some very large with maybe an 8 or more inch diameter trunk. But we didn't have very good luck the first time around. We planted a large redwood and a large white pine, both of which died. The nursery was very good and stood behind it, and we now have a Schwedler maple that looks very good and a red oak. The red oak was planted last August, and it was very full and very large, probably at least 15 feet tall. This year, it came back okay, but it's been, the leaves are small. It has a lot of acorns on it, which I thought might be a good sign. But even my smaller sentinel maples in the front of the house have very small leaves, too. Has that got anything to do with the moisture?
Well,
and I guess my secondary question would be, is there anything top dressing or anything that you should do to try and amend the soil or over time?
Well, as far as the small leaf size, that's kind of a sign, a symptom of a tree that's having some problems. That's why they're smaller than normal. Now, when you plant a tree, it often takes 2 or 3 years for that tree to get established. And so they do require good care during that period. But they can have some problems initially. Now, when you have a clay soil, I guess the first thing would be you want to select plants that can tolerate those type of soils. Not everything will or can. And so as far as tree-wise, I would look at things like, for example, the honey locust, linden, crabapple. A number of trees will actually tolerate clay soils fairly well. They'll be fine. The other thing is when you plant trees in a clay soil, you want to plant them fairly high. So if you plant a tree, the first thing that I would do is go out there and measure the height of the soil ball. And let's and say...
Oh, I'm sorry. The nurseryman did tell us that when he did plant both these large trees the second time. They're a good 12 inches above the soil.
Right. You want to plant them high. So we say, for example, the top third of the soil ball should be above the surrounding terrain when you plant in a clay soil. The other thing is, when you plant in a clay soil, to dig a hole that's quite wide, maybe two or three times the diameter of the soil ball, and then backfill with that original soil. Don't add anything to it, like compost or peat or anything like that. When you dig a wide hole, at least for a year or two, the soil is not as compacted, so it does give the tree a little bit of a chance to grow out into the surrounding soil for a short period, which is good. So that's the reason for doing that. In a clay soil, the biggest concern is keeping it too wet. They just don't like that, most trees. And if you plant them too deep and they're sitting in a hole, the water tends to collect in that hole when it rains a lot, and that's a very bad situation. So that's why they should be a little bit higher than what we typically do. But you can't do much once you have the trees in the ground. The tree basically is kind of up to itself, and hopefully if you have a tree that can tolerate those conditions, if you planted it correctly, hopefully it's going to survive, but it may have some problems initially.
All right. Well, good luck with that, Peg. Thank you so much for your call today. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Paul is on the line in Des Moines. Hello, Paul.
Hello. How you doing?
Great. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I've got an ash tree in my front lawn, and I know everyone's concerned about ash borer, and the leaves on the tree are curling up and turning brown and falling off, and I'm wondering if that's either all the rain we've gotten recently, or if it's a sign that the ash borer has got the tree.
Probably not the ash borer. There are certain things that we look for as far as the ash borer. Leaf drop or canopy decline is a symptom, but that's a kind of a general symptom for decline of any tree, so that's not very specific. So in addition to that, as far as with the emerald ash borer, we typically expect to see a lot of suckers at the base of the trunk, because the insects are damaging most of the above-ground part of the tree, so the tree in response to that typically suckers quite a bit at the base. So we see a lot of suckers. Okay. We also oftentimes see a lot of woodpecker activity, because if there's enough of these insects in the tree to cause the tree to decline and die, they're quite numerous, and the woodpeckers find them and then peck at them. So you see a lot of that activity also. So when you see two or three of those things occurring, then you might think it's emerald ash borer. If you're just seeing some decline, it's probably due to other reasons. Ash trees are one of our most common trees, and every once in a while you see one that's not doing well. That's pretty normal.
So the moisture and all the rain we've had isn't necessarily a contributing factor to that?
It may not be. Ash are pretty adaptable. You'll find those in dry situations, even those areas that are fairly wet. They're pretty adaptable. That's why they're one of our most common native trees. And when a tree declines, though, it could be due to a number of things that may have occurred in the last 5 or 10 years. And oftentimes it's very hard to pinpoint exactly what that was.
All right, Paul, thank you so much for your call. And next up we have Dave, who is on the line from somewhere near San Francisco, California. Hello, Dave.
Hey, greetings. Yeah, we've got a nice foggy day out here. Hey, you know what? I'm originally from St. Louis, so I got a lot of relatives back there, and you always think of the region. The Gulf of Mexico is being devastated with all that Corexit and the spill itself, and the ongoing poisoning that's going on in the other 4,300 wells or God knows how many. So I'm just wondering, what could be done? The remaining water that's going into the Gulf of Mexico is down the Mississippi, and that's full of pesticides and hazardous wastes and all sorts of things. The few remaining fish in the Gulf are dying to get a taste of free water, and we're just pouring endless on top of them. So we may be doing a huge choke point this very minute. And I'm trying to figure out how the upper Mississippi and upper Ohio and Illinois and Missouri and even Tennessee River, should be reducing every amount. And I'm just wondering, logically, what would you suggest for how to get that started?
Well, that's kind of out of the area of expertise here, but would you guys like to respond?
I would just say it's a very complex issue that is not easily solved. You do have production things occurring, obviously, in Iowa as far as crop production and things like that. Mm-hmm. It's a very complex issue, way beyond what I would basically have expertise in.
Me too. All right. Well, Dave, thanks for listening online, though. You, of course, can listen to Talk of Iowa online anytime at iowapublicradio.org. We have time for one more question from email. And I know we don't have an entomologist on the air, but Richard, I'm sure you've heard something like this already. Can you tell me what kind of bug is in my tomato? They're shaped and similar size to the Japanese beetle, but they're all brown. That's Laura in Cedar Rapids. Do you have an idea?
All brown. Boy, I don't know.
And a beetle?
And a beetle.
That's what she says.
We see a lot of sap beetles. They will attack damaged fruit, but they're black with spots on them.
And they're much smaller than
much smaller. So I really don't know what that would be offhand, no.
All right, well.
Sorry.
good luck with that, Laura. Richard Geron and Linda Nave, thank you both so much for being here today. Iowa State University Extension Specialist Linda Nave and Iowa State University Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron. We do Hort Day every Friday here on Talk of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Tom Odding in Ames. We always welcome your comments. You can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe, and Monday on Talk of Iowa, my guest will be Simon Estes. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.